Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the editorial director for the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm here on the phone with Bernadette Melnick, who is Dean and Distinguished Foundation Professor of Nursing at Arizona State University College of Nursing and Health Innovation. And I'm also here with Ellen Feinout-Overholt, who is Clinical Professor and Director of the Center for the Advancement of Evidence-Based Practice at the Arizona State University College of Nursing and Health Innovation. So welcome to both of you. It's so glad you could join us on this mini interview. We're very excited. Bern and Ellen are leading a series on evidence-based practice beginning with our November 2009 issue. It's called Igniting a Spirit of Inquiry, an Essential Foundation for Evidence-Based Practice. That's the first column in our step-by-step evidence-based practice series. And the series is built so that organizations can follow along and use each installment in the series to help guide their own journey to implementing evidence-based practice. So let me start by asking you both about the whole evidence-based practice movement. And what was the impetus for you both, and what was the impetus really for thinking about doing this series, which certainly will require a lot of thought and work on your part?
Well, evidence-based practice is a true passion of mine. I am both a nurse practitioner as well as a researcher, and I was always astounded by the fact that it takes approximately 17 years to translate findings from research into clinical practice to improve patient care and outcomes. Right now, the Institute of Medicine has set a goal that by 2020, 90% of healthcare decisions will be evidence-based. But leaders across the country currently estimate that only about 10 to 15% of clinicians actually take a consistent approach to their care that is evidence-based. And it's unfortunate in that we know when we provide evidence-based care versus care that is steeped in tradition, our patient outcomes are at least 28% better. So we need to move this whole evidence-based practice paradigm more quickly in order to assure a higher quality of care and better outcomes for our patients.
Those figures are astounding. What percentage did you say that was?
Percentage in terms of percentage of clinicians,
yes,
that are consistently implementing evidence-based care, we estimate to be about 10 to 15% only.
So we have a lot of work to do.
We sure do.
It's an interesting dynamic when you encounter the healthcare system, which I have on several occasions in the past 10 years, and just recently. And when you hope that all the work that we have done has made an impact, and it has on many people, but what we need to realize is that it is not just all of the things that Bern has just said are exactly on target, and what it has to do is filter down to the point-of-care provider. And one of the things that motivates me is that point-of-care provider, and that it must be a paradigm that is lived at their point-of-care, where they live. And that means that it's got to be the administrators, to the financial folks, to the nurse managers, the physicians, all the folks in the healthcare team, including staff nurse, that has this as the way that they think. The evidence-based practice paradigm is how they think about their care, their collaboration with colleagues. Everything is about that patient outcome.
A daunting task, because when you think of nursing in the hospitals today, how rushed they are, everyone is so sick in hospitals, there's a nursing shortage, it's certainly hard to really get people to move from just trying to complete what they need to do that day. what are the important factors that, in having worked with many organizations, that you find is critical to make that move?
For one, Ellen and I have a model for evidence-based practice. It's called the Advancing Research and Clinical Practice Through Close Collaboration Model. It's referred to as ARC. And we have conducted at least a decade of studies to provide evidence behind the relationships in this particular model. But central to our ARC model is the role of an evidence-based practice mentor who works with direct care staff in honing their evidence-based practice skills and being able to consistently implement EBP at point of care. So those advanced, those mentors, are usually advanced practice nurses, but in some community hospitals they may be baccalaureate certified prepared nurses who, again, have good knowledge and skills of evidence-based practice, as well as good knowledge and skills in individual and organizational change. Because changing clinicians' behaviors truly is not easy. It's just like trying to change a patient's smoking behavior. If only education or information could translate into behavior change, it would be great, but that's not realistic. So we need mentors in our healthcare systems who have these skills to work with clinicians at point of care on a consistent basis. And that's a real key in implementing and sustaining evidence-based practice in the healthcare system.
I think one of the important pieces that we always talk about when Bernie and I help people implement this into their organizations, whether that's a primary care practice or a major tertiary care center, is that they have to have a vision for what they want to achieve. And the vision of having an evidence-based culture in an evidence-based organization where everyone is talking the talk and walking the walk is an imperative. There can't be a vision for administration and a vision that lives down in the trenches. So there has to be a consistent vision that is shared by everyone, and that is about how do we get the best outcomes for our patients, and that leads to then this cost-effective, efficient care that we all want as we encounter the healthcare system. It also helps people to think about new ways of doing things that is one of the foundational pieces of the evidence-based practice process that underpins actually it being able to live, is that spirit of inquiry that allows people the privilege to think of things in a different way that will get a better outcome and not be so entrenched into the thing that we shudder when we hear, and that is we've always done it that way. And so if you think of a hierarchical healthcare system, evidence-based practice is stymied in that kind of system. It needs that spirit of inquiry as that foundational, we call it step zero, set place so that it can underpin everything else that's going to go on in the evidence-based practice process.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about the step zero, because several of the editors, when we were going through the article, they kept saying, shouldn't this be step one, that's the first thing that's required? So we were very curious about why that's step zero and not step one.
Well, go ahead,
Ellen.
Step zero for us, you know, we think of things in a step-by-step process often in how we approach problem solving from, you know, whoever we are. It doesn't matter. But when you think of step zero, it's like it does have to be done before even the first step is taken. It's sort of like when a baby learns to walk, they have other motor things that they have to do in order to achieve that first step in some ways of thinking. So that's the first step to the mobility out there to really make it part of what we see as everyday living, you know. But before that, there are things that have to be done, and that is what step zero is. And the reason we call it that is sort of to call attention to it, to say that this is an essential. Everybody knows there's a step one. But when you say this is step zero, this is an imperative. This is the thing that is foundational. This is before you take that first step.
That makes a lot of sense then. And once you start working with an organization, do you find that people get it quickly about what you're trying to do and what they should be trying to do?
I think people have to realize again that this is a process and it's culture change, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I can tell you that one of the reasons why evidence-based practice paradigm has been slow to advance is because of the way that evidence-based practice, the way that research, rather, continues to be taught in our baccalaureate and master's programs. Students continue to be taught how to do the rigorous process of research instead of how to take an evidence-based approach to care. So they're coming out of their programs thinking that it's going to take them 4 weeks to do an evidence search because they haven't learned how to form PICO questions, and they haven't learned how to do searches in streamlined ways. When you learn evidence-based practice, you know, it's wonderful to see light bulbs going off all the time as people learn these new skills, and they don't take half as long as they thought they would take because of the way they had been educated in their traditional programs.
So is this changing? Do you think there's going to be not a backlash, but kind of this is a way to change the curriculum by showing that this process works? Are you changing curriculum at ASU, and are you seeing other places change curriculum to reflect more of this approach?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there is a mindset. When you teach a student about a nursing student, whether they're in the baccalaureate or master's programs, and you teach them about how to generate research, that they don't see that as part of their role. They don't see it as an important thing to assimilate into who they are in their role. They see it as academic, and they get through that course. And many times we've heard students say, well, are we going to ever use this again? Is this important to what we're going to do? You know, what hoop? Basically, the underlying message is, what hoop do we have to jump through to get through this course? And our curriculum is changing, has already changed significantly in the undergraduate program, and is changing and has changed in our graduate programs, because we realize the value of producing an evidence consumer and the person who's going to consume the evidence to be able to apply that knowledge to improve care at the point of care. And so and students love it. They relish it. They get excited about it because it empowers them to have a tool to use that they can then make a difference in what's actually happening with the people that they're caring for.
And from what you're saying, I can see how this will translate into improving the care delivery, much as what's being fostered in the Transforming Care at the Bedside movement that's quite popular now.
Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, you know, we're strong advocates that it would be so awesome to combine or fuel Transforming Care at the Bedside with a solid evidence-based practice approach to care. It'd be interesting to do a comparative effectiveness study to look at differences in outcomes with different approaches.
That's a good research project. Well, this is an exciting series, and I'm looking forward to the next installment. Now, the next column will appear in January, correct? And that will be actually talking about step one, I guess, if this is step zero.
an overview of all the steps,
right.
So to kind of get a good feel for what's coming, and then a more the step one actually begins in the following one in depth.
Okay, that's great. And for those of you who are listening to this podcast online, we will have more podcasts, but what we also will be doing is Ask the Experts, where in January, the date and time will be determined. We will be setting up a call with Byrne and Ellen and perhaps some of the other authors that have been involved in the series, and it'll give you a chance as a consumer of evidence-based practice to ask questions directly from the experts about your own projects that you're trying to implement. So we hope you will use this podcast to look for the articles and get excited by the series and start implementing your own projects using our series and the podcast and our chats with the experts. Any last comments you'd like to make, Byrne or Ellen?
Well, I would just encourage folks to really think about why they would want to invest some time, not only into reading the column, but putting some time in practicing the skills that will be in the column. I always like to ask people, if you were diagnosed with cancer today, wouldn't you want your oncologist caring for you to be up to date on the best and latest, most effective treatment, so you'd have the best chance of beating cancer? And when we reflect on that particular question, I don't think anybody would say that's not what we want. So if we would want that type of evidence-based care, we need to be delivering that to the patients for whom we care for and their families.
That's a great point. Well, thank you. Go ahead,
Bernie. My last encouragement on this particular podcast would be for folks, as they read, to think of something that they're passionate about changing, something that they see that they would like to invest in, as Byrne said, and then follow along over that year's time with the steps that we're going to outline, and be able to then at the end of the column, when the column ends, I believe it's next April, a year from April, that they would be able to then sit down and talk about, when we have our final talk with the experts, that they would be able to talk about what improvement they've been able to achieve, which would be pretty exciting.
That would be. That's great. Well, thank you both very much, and we look forward to the next podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.